And now,
great to be back.
Back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
Awesome.
And your host, Bill Frank.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business and politics. Each of my guests will share his or her perspective on one of these topics. My next guest believes our global financial system is broken and is destroying the middle class. We'll discuss his findings contained in his book, The Unfair Trade. Michael Casey is the former bureau chief of Dow Jones Newswires in Buenos Aires and a principal correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Argentina. He has been a journalist for 15 years, starting out at the West Australia newspaper in Perth, Australia. Michael's career has included long stints in Perth, Bangkok, Jakarta, Buenos Aires, and now New York. He lives and works in New York City, joining us from the Big Apple. Hi, Michael. How are you today?
Hi there, Bill. Very well. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. Loved your book because it was so thought-provoking. And I'm just going to take the other side of the argument, if we can, starting
Absolutely.
Off. The book is titled The Unfair Trade, How Our Broken Global Financial System Destroys the Middle Class. And I just want to talk about some of the positive things that globalization has done. First of all, the number of people living on only $1.25 a day has actually dropped by 400 million between 1990 and 2005.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a 7-year increase in life expectancy from the years 1990 to 2010, a 47% decline in infant mortality during that same period.
Mm-hmm.
And literacy has skyrocketed as high as it can go to 84% among people 15 years or older. That's an 11% increase. So if you believe in Adam Smith, he's right that free trade and integration really do lead to more efficient production of goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at all of these things in aggregate, even taking into account the financial collapse of 2008 to 2010, things are better off because of globalization. So where's the unfair trade?
Well, that's very good. I think we're quoting from me there, weren't you not? In the front section of the book, I actually point all those things out, because the position I'm taking in this book is indeed that globalization is a force for good, or can be a force for good at least. And those are all undeniable gains, and I think it's appropriate for us to think about the gains from the broad sector, the broad wash of humanity. And I just think it's very hard to say that it hasn't been good on that level. My point, however, is that this is not the globalization that we should be striving for. What we've got is globalization that is unbalanced, that is distorted by subsidies in certain places, by misaligned policies in different places, whether it's in China or in the U.S. or in Europe, that ends up favoring some sectors of society and holding everybody else back. And that's not an issue. That's not a socialist issue. That's an issue about making sure that that capitalism, that the free market itself, is allowed to operate properly rather than being subsidized by some groups being subsidized by the rest of us. And I think that what's happened is we've dangerously shifted towards a very unbalanced structure in the global economy, and that's undermining people's confidence in how it works, and unfortunately, I think, driving us towards a pullback away from the good things in globalization and toward a more isolationist posture, which I think can be very, very damaging. We need to work on making globalization work properly.
Well, I'm a big fan of globalization, as you probably know, but give us some idea of the unbalanced or distortions that you see right now that is corrupting globalization.
Well, I mean, currencies don't float equally around the world, for one, right? We know that some currencies float, some currencies, like the Chinese one, are fixed or at least very tightly managed and subject to capital controls and so forth. That creates a big pricing distortion in terms of the allocation of capital in certain places. It becomes a very attractive proposition under that scenario to build exporting bases in China, for example, and not in the United States. Now, there's nothing to say that China isn't a very good and efficient competitor on all sorts of levels and doesn't deserve to be a big manufacturing base. But if you're distorting the price so much as that, you end up building up activity in one area when you really should be building it up everywhere. And everybody knows, in fact, that what China needs to be doing now is to turn itself into a consumer society, because it's creating its own imbalances, its own distortions in its own society by not actually allowing these market forces to sort of steer people into the areas of business that they should be in. So that's a big one, and it actually ends up distorting things in the United States, because as China invests, as the Chinese central bank buys dollars, for example, to keep down its currency, those dollars it has to put somewhere else. And we all know it a lot of it, trillions of it, ends up in the United States, which creates this sort of codependent relationship between China and the U.S. and drives down the price of credit in this country to equally artificial levels, which breeds a lot of interest in the finance sector or in the housing sector. We all know this was the story behind the bubble before the crisis. Those are huge distortions, and we haven't really sorted them out. We've got a long way to go in terms of cleaning up those, and I would argue that we can't clean them up until we coordinate those policy imbalances with the Chinese and with other countries as well.
Well, my guest is Michael Casey. We're talking about his book, The Unfair Trade. And Michael, I am by no means a China apologist, but I'm going to take the Chinese side for just a minute. They're having one of the greatest migrations in human history from the country into the cities. They're trying to manage an aging population. They're trying to manage this migration. They're challenged on a number of different levels because they are a communist country with state-run policies and everything else. They're trying just to manage their own economy. Certain things they're going to have to do in order to make that possible. And yes, it will have its impact on us here in the United States. There's no question about it. But it's every country for itself. It's a free nation. I mean, how do you comment on that, please?
Well, I think it's actually, we live in a world that at some point is going to have to be questioned, that it's every nation for themselves. Nation states don't have the power they had. We have been the sovereignty that we assume exists in terms of our policy making doesn't exist in the way that it did. Global banks operate, global finance operates, independently in a very significant way of nation states policies. Now, of course, every bank is regulated and there are rules around this sort of stuff, but really we do live in a highly globalized financial environment, but a highly domestically politicized political environment. That's a contradiction. So China, to be thought of what China is doing as a nation and whether it should be allowed to do as it pleases is a reasonable idea position to hold, except for the fact that the whole world is deeply affected by those decisions, but so are Chinese people themselves. And I think that, for a nation like this one that believes in democracy, believes in free markets, believes in an open system, we need to be thinking about the structure of the Chinese economy, the structure of the Chinese political system, and how it in fact does distort the economy there in China, but also here. They have it's in their own interest, in fact, to try to advance the consumers in their society. It may not be in the interest of the regime, but who should we care about more, 1.3 billion Chinese or the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, I find it very interesting, Michael, that we send Timothy Geithner over to China probably once a year to poke them in the eye with a stick and say, you need to let the yuan float, just as you're proposing here, and every time they kind of rebuff him and yes, go away. The reality is that they are buying $1.169 trillion of our U.S. Treasury debt. By far the single largest holder of our debt as a nation state would be China. And so here we are poking our largest creditor in the eye, telling them that they should free up their economy. It almost seems laughable. If you came down from Mars to see that, you would laugh at the farce. You would laugh at the comedy of that.
I don't think that it's actually particularly constructive necessarily to sort of be picking fights with China. I'm not really advocating that at all.
Okay.
I actually do believe in multilateralism, which doesn't necessarily sit well with lots of conservatives I know, but nonetheless, I think it is the only way to approach this. There has to be a give and take. If we're just fighting over this and taking a blustering position, you're right, it's kind of farcical because of the fact that we don't have a lot of bargaining power on our own position. But on top of that, it's actually not the answer. The answer is to get both sides' policies more in line. And that's the challenge, the massive challenge that we face. We need to think about international solutions, not national ones. It's as complicated but as simple as that in one breath. I just think in terms of, though, this question about whether or not we have we can tell China what to do. Remember, China itself is in a very difficult position precisely because of that $1.6 trillion debt. You know, the old expression that if you, I think it was in Keynes, but it might have been somebody else, that if you owe the bank $100, you have a problem. If the bank owes you $1 million, if you owe the bank $1 million, the bank has a problem. And China is... In that situation, it knows that it can't actually withdraw its holdings from the U.S. without having the market turn against them and have a fundamental threat to its national resources. And I think we're both in this rather ugly codependent relationship. It's in our interest jointly to come up with an alternative.
My guest is Michael Casey, author of the book, The Unfair Trade, How Our Broken Global Financial System Destroys the Middle Class. Let's flip to the other side of the globe, if we can, for just a minute, Michael, and let's talk about what's going on in Europe right now. Europe took steps to go multilateral, like you were saying. They came up with the euro about a dozen years ago, and now we're in the midst of one of the greatest financial crises that Europe has ever seen. So here are people doing exactly what you propose that they do, trying to unify and so forth, and yet it's falling flat on their face. Where did they go wrong? What's happening here that's different from what you're proposing in the book?
Well, in fact, I don't think it's that different at all. I mean, it is... Europe just did it all completely wrong. I know that sounds like a cop-out, like I'm trying to find some easy way to be consistent here, but the fact is I'm talking about political integration, political coordination, and Europe didn't. Europe has stuck to the nation-state model at the political level. The one thing it did do was build the same currency. It did it a lot of people are now pointing out, it put the cart before the horse. And as a result, is now having to... The only way out of this for Europe, in fact, is to politically unify. Now, whether or not they would have been better staying off as individual states and keeping their currencies, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, they have no choice now but to move forward. To disintegrate would be disastrous. So integration is the means by which they get to do what the United States did under the Hamiltonian solution here, where the debts became shared across different states. The colonial debts were absorbed by the central state, and you get to ameliorate and smooth the differences that exist. It's extremely difficult politically to do in a country where everybody speaks different languages and have different cultures, much harder than it was in the United States. Nonetheless, to resolve the contradictions that now exist within the monetary union, it is the only solution. So in that sense, it's consistent with what I'm arguing.
Well,
and I would say one more thing just quickly, and that is that the euro, as much as it's now causing huge problems, it really did bring a lot of benefits for a number of years. And there was some logic to the principle, or they just forgot they had to have this second part to it, and that was that once you unify exchange rates, it makes it a lot easier to move money across borders.
Well, yay if you're Greece, that sounds great. Boo if you're Germany, because that doesn't sound so great. And if you're England or Norway sitting on the sideline, you're probably laughing all the way to the bank. My guest is Michael Casey, author of the book, The Unfair Trade. So, Michael, how is this destroying the middle class? Because as I look at this, China has a middle class of 300 million people. That is roughly the size of the United States. That's just their middle class. India has a burgeoning middle class. Vietnam, Indonesia, places where you have lived and worked as well, all have these burgeoning middle classes. I don't see the middle class going away except for industrialized countries like the United States. So how is this killing off the middle class?
Well, the title to the book, of course, is very much targeted at the American middle class rather than the rest of the world. But it's a very good question, because I do want to be clear that this is a book about the way people everywhere are affected by that. And I agree with you. The middle class is growing in these places, and that's a good thing. It goes back to those statistics that you quoted from my book earlier on. Now, what I would say, though, is that that doesn't mean that this development of a middle class is happening in an equitable way. And I mean equitable not in terms of a communist idea, but equitable in a sense that this is a truly fair go, proper level playing field style form of free market. These are, and China's a classic example. If you are a migrant worker and you move from, say, Hunan to Shanghai to work on an assembly line for 12 hours a day for 6 days a week, you are denied the public health care that you would have got back in your own home. Your kids don't get to go to the same schools. All of this is a means of controlling that block of people, and you are forced to save money. That savings then goes into the Chinese financial system, makes it very easy for large businesses to draw upon this pool of savings and benefit an elite of exporters. You're consequently creating a very large wealth gap in China. And as much as these people are better off than the way they were, they are definitely the ones who are paying for the benefits of the others. It is a subsidy from Chinese consumers, Chinese workers, to Chinese exporters and Chinese construction companies. That's what's happening.
Michael, then roll it forward for us. Do you think that in time that the Chinese will rise up against the government and eventually move towards a more free market society?
I do think that's inevitable, and I think that we should embrace that. I don't think that you want to see China fall into a state of unrest. I do think, to the credit of the government, there are certainly reformist voices within the Chinese Communist Party. We just had an interview today in the Wall Street Journal from the manager of the big sovereign wealth fund, the Chinese Investment Corp, and he was talking about the need to remove capital controls, which would be a huge liberalization of the financial system and bring great benefit to these savers who've been repressed by these artificially low interest rates that they have to deal with in that country. So there are voices within the Chinese establishment who are indeed talking about a reformist approach, and that is the way we want to go, of course. We don't want to go through a massive kind of revolutionary disruption. I do think it's inevitable, to get back to your original question. It is. China wants to grow. China wants to keep going. China wants to be a player on the world stage. To do so, it needs to reform within. And hopefully there are enough people there who recognize that. Of course, the flip side is that there are hardliners who think that the only solution is to clamp down. And we're constantly hearing stories about censorship and human rights activists being arrested and so forth. And so it is a contradictory environment.
Well, it's a contradictory environment. It is a play that is still developing, as they say. My guest has been Michael Casey, author of the book, The Unfair Trade, How Our Broken Global Financial System Destroys the Middle Class. Michael, if people are intrigued by what you have to say, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Well, first of all, of course, they can pick up the book at Amazon.com, but also my own website will have some information. That's michaeljcasey.com. Those are two places. I write a column once a week called FX Horizons for WSJ.com, but also in MarketWatch. There you'll find some of my writings, but certainly michaeljcasey.com is a good place to start.
michaeljcasey.com. Michael, thank you so much for being my guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you.